Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. I'm David Cruz in for Brian Lehrer today. We're continuing our coverage of the Supreme Court hearings on marriage equality. Yesterday, the Supreme Court heard a challenge to California's Proposition 8. That's the state's ban on same-sex marriage that was passed by voters in 2008. We have lots of sound that we want to play from yesterday's arguments. So I want to bring in our guest, Jeffrey Stone. He is a professor of law at the University of Chicago Law School. Jeffrey, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Delighted to be here.
So there's a lot to get into here, but before we start analyzing today's events, can you just give us a brief synopsis of what exactly went before the court yesterday?
Okay. Well, the basic issue is whether California's Proposition 8 is constitutional. Before Proposition 8, the California Supreme Court had decided that under the California Constitution, it was unconstitutional for the state not to allow gays and lesbians to marry. Prop 8 was adopted as an amendment to the state constitution to overrule the California Supreme Court decision and to reinstate the notion that only men and women can marry. Then that Prop 8 was challenged in federal court. And the federal district court held that it was unconstitutional, violating the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. The state of California then refused to defend Proposition 8, concluding that it was unconstitutional. And the question was who then can appeal. And the Court of Appeals out in California allowed the proponents of Prop 8, those who had put together the proposition, to defend its constitutionality. And then the Ninth Circuit, the federal Court of Appeals there, affirmed that as it held Proposition 8 unconstitutional, and now the case is before the U.S. Supreme Court.
All right, so that's the Prop 8 side of this week of hearings on marriage equality, and just remind us of the difference between yesterday's and today's arguments before the court.
Okay, so today the court is considering the constitutionality of the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, and what the Federal Defense of Marriage Act does is to define for purposes of federal law a marriage as between a man and a woman. And therefore, even if a state, like, say, New York, allows same-sex couples to marry, under federal law, that marriage will not count. And therefore, for the thousands of benefits that exist under federal law, for example, being able to file a joint tax return and all sorts of other Social Security benefits, Medicare or Medicaid benefits and so on that go to married couples, a married couple in New York who happens to be same-sex will not be eligible for any of those federal benefits under federal law because of the Defense of Marriage Act. And that's being challenged as unconstitutional. It, too, is held unconstitutional in the lower courts, and it's now being considered today by the Supreme Court of the United States.
So, all right, that's a good catching us up there. The Supreme Court released audio of the arguments about 1 o'clock yesterday afternoon, but of course, in this age of Twitter, word was leaking out of the court much earlier. One of the most circulated tweets was SCOTUS blog just around 11 o'clock in the morning saying there are not 5 votes to strike down Prop 8 and recognize equal rights to same-sex marriage at this time. Was that your analysis of what you heard yesterday?
Well, I think you have to be very careful about drawing inferences from oral argument. The justices' questions are designed for a variety of purposes. Some of them are designed to get answers that they're curious about, to see if they can understand the issues better. Some of them are designed to influence their fellow justices. So I think the media tend to be a little too quick to conclude, based on a couple of questions, that they know where the justices are actually going to wind up. So I think that's generally something we have to be cautious about. On the other hand, I think it's probably the case that it's unlikely that 5 justices will agree to hold Prop 8 unconstitutional in a way that would mean that there's a constitutional right to same-sex marriage nationally. That is, I don't think they will adopt the most expansive view of the constitutional issue, mainly because I think their view is that the country is not quite ready for such a decision, and it would be better to take an intermediate step And then later come back and revisit the larger question. So I think that's a reasonable understanding of what the where the majority of the justices is today.
You know, there's always this question of how much do the justices pay attention to public opinion. And seeing as how public opinion is switched on this, I mean, tremendously over the past several years, is there any sense that the judges are the justices are saying, well, you know, let's deal with this in California, but let the larger question be handled by the states and the politicians in individual states?
I don't think that a majority of the current justices would take that view in the long run. I think that, that they fully understand that in the realm of constitutional rights, we don't leave them to the majority in each and every individual state. The very notion of constitutional rights is that they trump what the majority may want. So in the same way that in Brown and Board of Education, the Supreme Court held that separate but equal schools were unconstitutional, even though 15, 16 states themselves still wanted to do that, or in Loving versus Virginia, the court held that the laws prohibiting blacks and whites from marrying were unconstitutional. So my sense is that they're not saying, and they won't say, leave this entirely to the states. I doubt that. I think more likely what they're saying is that we're a little bit ahead of the game right now. Let's let more states make their judgment on this question. We'll come back and revisit it in 2, 3, 4 years when it's a little bit clearer that the overall direction is going to be comfortable with our ruling, and then we'll come back and do it.
Boy, it seems to me that with all the excitement around all of this week, that a ruling like that would be a really big disappointment for a lot of people.
Well, I think that it's interesting because when Ted Olson and David Boies filed this case initially, only a couple of years ago in California, the general view among same-sex marriage advocates was extremely uneasy. Their view was that they were getting ahead of the game and they were being arrogant about their own status as great litigators, and the risks they were taking were enormous. And what's interesting is over even the last couple of years, that perspective has changed to the point where now there's a genuine expectation that certainly the court will not hold that Prop 8 is constitutional. I think nobody believes that. The only question is how far they go in striking it down. And so that's a huge change. And to the extent people came in with the belief that the court was going to strike down same-sex marriage nationally, that's very optimistic. I don't think that's impossible, by the way. I think that is a possible outcome here. But I think the odds are that they will look for some more cautious approach and then come back and revisit the question in a couple of years.
All right, let's get into some of the audio that was released yesterday. I found it fascinating, if not only for content, but also for some of the tone of the exchanges between the justices and the litigators. So all eyes were on Justice Anthony Kennedy yesterday, as they often are in contentious cases brought before the court. He's regarded as the decisive swing vote. So let's take a listen to one of the most reported exchanges of the day.
The problem with the case is that you're really asking, particularly because of the sociological evidence you cite, for us to go into uncharted waters, and you can play with that metaphor. There's a wonderful destination or there's a cliff, whatever the metaphor is. But you're doing so in a case where the opinion is very narrow, basically that once the state goes halfway, it has to go all the way or 70% of the way. And you're doing so in a case where there's a substantial question on standing. I just wonder if the case was properly granted.
So what does he mean when he says that he's not sure the case was properly granted?
So what he seems to be suggesting is that in some instances, once the court – okay, first thing to understand is the Supreme Court decides whether to hear cases. It has a discretionary jurisdiction, and it agrees to hear only 1 or 2% of all the cases that want to be reviewed in the Supreme Court. So it has the authority to decide whether to agree to hear or to decide a case. What he's suggesting is that, well, you know, maybe on reflection, we just shouldn't have agreed to hear this case. maybe it's not ready for us, the issues aren't really ripe, and we made a mistake in agreeing to hear the case, so we should just dismiss the grant of hearing, as the phrase is, as improvidently granted.
What does that mean?
That's an unusual thing for the court to do, but not unheard of.
What does it mean?
Well, it means basically that it's as if they didn't agree to hear the case. It means the Ninth Circuit opinion stands. It's the law in California. Prop 8 is unconstitutional. But from the national perspective, the issue is still unresolved.
So they can just decide. Can they just decide that now? Or is it too late to do that?
No, they can absolutely decide that. They can just say that, you know, now that we've gotten the chance to explore the issues, we think it's not something we should be deciding right now, period.
You say that's very rare.
It's rare, but it's not unheard of.
Okay. Yet early in the day, Kennedy made one of the more impassioned statements from the bench. Let's take a listen to that.
On the other hand, there is an immediate legal injury or legal what could be a legal injury, and that's the voice of these children. There are some 40,000 children in California, according to the red brief, that live with same-sex parents. And they want their parents to have full recognition and full status. The voice of those children is important in this case, don't you think?
So as a watcher of the court, what in your estimation is he thinking there?
Well, I think what Kennedy there is basically doing is responding to the argument that, you know, what's the harm in not allowing same-sex marriage? And he's saying, even apart from the harm to the adults who want to be married, he says there's also a harm here to the children of same-sex couples, who are allowed to have children in California, not giving their parents the benefit of marriage. That's a real disadvantage for those kids. And therefore, the decision not to allow same-sex marriage has real consequences that shouldn't be ignored. Now, what to make of that in terms of predicting his vote, I don't think it speaks volumes. I think it basically is it's an interesting point to make. It doesn't tell me how Kennedy is going to ultimately vote in the case. So I think he's doing a little bit of playing devil's advocate there and making clear that this is not costless, that to simply say that people can't marry has real consequences, not only for them as adults, but also for their children. And I think it reflects Kennedy's real view. I mean, Kennedy's real view, I believe, is that the denial of same-sex marriage is unconstitutional. It's unjust, it violates the Equal Protection Clause, and it's indefensible. But I think his view is probably tempered by the fact of not wanting to get too far ahead of public opinion. But I have no doubt that if Anthony Kennedy were forced to vote, he'd be only two choices, uphold Prop 8 or strike down Prop 8, he would strike it down.
One of the core arguments of those defending the law is that marriage is a means to an end, and that end is procreation. And this resulted in one of the more colorful exchanges of the day between Charles Cooper, the lawyer arguing against same-sex marriage, and Justice Elena Kagan. This is a bit of a longer clip, but let's take a listen.
The concern is that redefining marriage as a genderless institution will sever its abiding connection to its historic, traditional, procreative purposes, and it will refocus the purpose of marriage and the definition of marriage away from the raising of children and to the emotional needs and desires of adults, of adult couples.
Well, suppose Mr. Cooper, suppose a state said, because we think that the focus of marriage really should be on procreation, we're not going to give marriage licenses anymore to any couple where both people are over the age of 55. Would that be constitutional?
No, Your Honor, it would not be constitutional.
Because that's the same state interest, I would think, you know. If you're over the age of 55, you don't help us serve the government's interest in regulating procreation through marriage. So why is that different?
Your Honor, even with respect to couples over the age of 55, it is very rare that both parties to the couple are infertile. And the traditional
if a couple I can just assure you, if both the woman and the man are over the age of 55, there are not a lot of children coming out of that marriage.
Your Honor, society's interest in responsible procreation isn't just with respect to the procreative capacities of the couple itself. The marital norm, which imposes the obligations of fidelity and monogamy, Your Honor, advances the interests in responsible procreation.
So, I mean, that's one of Cooper's major arguments, no? I mean, how did he fare in that exchange in your mind?
Well, to be honest, it's a completely disingenuous and unpersuasive argument. And Justice Kagan demonstrated that quite clearly. Cooper had no answers to her apt questions. The truth is, you know, as Kagan was pointing out, people could always marry whether or not they were going to have children. And same-sex couples do have children. So it's just a stupid argument, and I don't think anybody on the court will accept it.
I thought that whole concept of regulating procreation through marriage was kind of odd. Is that part of the government's job?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, Cooper's problem is he's got to justify a statute which is basically rooted in two things. It's rooted in religion, and it's rooted in tradition. And neither of those ultimately is a very good argument in the face of a serious constitutional challenge.
You know,
and so he's got to come up with something, and this is what he came up with. But as Kagan, I think, quite aptly demonstrated, it's not an argument that should be taken seriously.
That was one of the funnier exchanges, and there was a lot of laughter during the proceedings yesterday, in sharp contrast, I think, to some of the passion that's been expressed about this issue, especially outside of the Supreme Court yesterday. Is there a sense that we can gauge anything from that, the tone of the
no.
of the no?
No, no. I think the justices are obviously dead serious about the issue. They understand consequences on both sides. They feel, I suspect, very strongly, as many of us do on both sides, that this is a very important issue. And the humor is just part of the game of oral argument, and I wouldn't read anything into it.
So then Cooper moved into onto the issue of how allowing gay marriage would harm the institution of marriage as a whole, which led to this exchange.
Explain that a little bit to me, just because I did not pick this up in your briefs. What harm you see happening, and when and how, and what harm to the institution of marriage or to opposite-sex couples? How does this cause and effect work?
Once again, I would reiterate that we don't believe that's the correct legal question before the court, and that the correct question is whether or not redefining marriage to include same-sex couples would advance the interests of marriage as opposed to...
Well, then are you conceding the point that there is no harm or denigration to traditional opposite-sex marriage couples? So
no,
you're conceding that?
No, Your Honor, no. I'm not conceding that.
It seems to me that you should have to address Justice Kagan's question.
Thank you, Justice Kennedy. I have 2 points to make on that. The first one is this. The plaintiff's expert acknowledged that redefining marriage will have real-world consequences, and that it is impossible for anyone to foresee the future accurately enough to know exactly what those real-world consequences would be. And among those real-world consequences, Your Honor, we would suggest are adverse consequences. But consider the California voter in 2008 in the ballot booth, with the question before her whether or not this age-old bedrock social institution should be fundamentally redefined, and knowing that there's no way that she or anyone else could possibly know what the long-term implications of a profound redefinition of a bedrock social institution would be. That is reason enough, Your Honor. That would hardly be irrational for that voter to say. I believe that this experiment, which is now only barely 4 years old, even in Massachusetts, the oldest state that is conducting it, to say, I think it better for California to hit the pause button and await additional information from the jurisdictions where this experiment is still maturing.
So what happened there?
Well, I mean, I think Cooper had difficulty explaining why allowing same-sex marriage would in fact harm the institution of marriage. I do think he had a better answer than the one he gave, in fact. That if I were Cooper in his position, what I would have said in response to the court is that many people in this country, a declining number, but many people believe that a marriage is only between a man and a woman, and believe that allowing two men or two women to marry is a mockery of marriage. They believe that. Whether that's right, wrong, or indifferent doesn't matter. It's what they believe. And if we allow same-sex marriage, the argument goes, they will take marriage less seriously. They will regard marriage as no longer a sacred institution, no longer even a serious institution. And that with that, it means that they're either less likely to get married, or they're more likely to get divorced, or they're more likely to commit adultery, and whatever. That they're just not likely to take the institution as seriously as they once did, and that's bad for society. That strikes me actually as a rational argument. It's not, in my view, a sufficient argument to justify upholding Prop 8. But if I were Cooper, I would have made that argument, and I would have said that, you know, at least arguably, recognizing same-sex marriage can have a harm to the institution of marriage, at least insofar as it undermines the respect for the institution among those people who believe that having same-sex marriage is a mockery.
Right.
And that's the argument I think you should have made. I don't think the court's going to decide the case on that basis, but if you're looking for a rational justification for the law, that's at least in the ballpark.
Yeah. So there was also this exchange between Ted Olson, representing the plaintiff, and Chief Justice John Roberts.
It's just about the label in this case.
The label is
same-sex couples have every other right. It's just about the label.
The label marriage means something. Even our opponents.
Sure. If you tell a child that somebody has to be their friend, I suppose you can force the child to say, this is my friend, but it changes the definition of what it means to be a friend. And that's, it seems to me, what the supporters of Proposition 8 are saying here. All you're interested in is the label, and you insist on changing the definition of the label.
It is like you were to say you can vote, you can travel, but you may not be a citizen. There are certain labels in this country that are very, very critical. You could have said in the Loving case, what you can't get married, but you can have an interracial union. Everyone would know that that was wrong. The marriage has a status, recognition, support, and you...
I thought that was an interesting exchange. Jeff Stone, what do you think?
Well, I think Olson was clearly right on that one. I hope Chief Justice Roberts was asking that question not seriously, but just to give Olson the chance to address the issue. Because, of course, the label, the name matters. If someone proposed a law that said Catholics can only have civil unions, they can't marry, you could imagine that the Catholic community would be up in arms and crazy furious. They would understand the insult and the indignity to that. Or if the same law was applied to African Americans, they can't marry, they can only have civil unions. No one should seriously believe that the refusal to give the label marriage to particular types of unions is anything but extremely denigrating and insulting. And to think of this as not a matter of consequence is silly. The other aspect of it is Robert suggests here, well, we change the meaning of the word. If we allow an institution that was always understood to be defined as a man and a woman to now include two men or two women. And, of course, in some sense, that's true. We change the definition. But that's law. The whole nature of law is that legal concepts change and evolve over time. That's inherent in the idea of law. That's true for what is a contract, or what does equal mean, or what does free speech mean, what does freedom of religion mean. Those concepts all change and evolve over time, inevitably, in every facet of law. And so the notion that definitions are somehow sacrosanct is completely foreign to the concept of law. And again, I can't imagine Chief Justice Roberts doesn't fully understand that.
All right. Jeff Stone is a professor of law at the University of Chicago Law School. Appreciate your insights. Thanks very much.
My pleasure. Take care.
David Cruz in for Brian Lehr on WNYC. Up next, America's disability boom. Stay there.